to it on its webpage. I think Richie is alluding to Palomar Laboratories that sells ferrites and balance as well. But the company that manufactures his antenna tends to recommend balance designs, which are kind of pretty much believed to be a very well-designed...
So I think you're saying, Roy, from your reading, he should consider Palomar Ballon Designs as the brand name of the Ballon that he needs. Right now, there's a lot of evidence that Ballon is creating this grief. And I think you've done research to find out that certain kinds of ferrite, when overdriven and overheated, will give you a permanent change in its characteristics. And that could be creating an awful lot of what we're seeing. See if all of that rings true to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2RAW.
UFIU. One second, George, and I'll give you time. By the way, Rich, K2UPS on Echolink also suggests the Ballon design. Ferrites are interesting things. Sometimes you can irreversibly damage it. Sometimes you can temporarily damage it by running too much heat through it, too much power through it. It heats up the cores, and they lose their soft ferrite qualities, which wreaks havoc with its estimation of impedances. And so, I as I said before, I would probably, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. Cobra Ultralight, the company by K1JEK, recommends the Ballon Designs version of a 4-to-1 Ballon. I would probably go there rather than jump around. Palomar Labs are nice if you like ferrites, but I've never really seen anything terribly special about them, but they're okay. But I would go with the guy who built his antenna as a recommendation. That's my two cents.
Okay, in the background I'm hearing K2GJE. GJE, go right ahead, sir.
Thank you, Dick. This is Ed, K2GJE. You don't need high power to measure SWR. He could use his Yaesu, his antenna tuna, his present Ballon, of course his existing antenna. That way he can measure SWR with that antenna and that Ballon on the frequencies that he operates, and that will eliminate the antenna. Then it all seems to boil down to when he pushes high power from his afterburner. Over, Ed.
Yeah, I almost 100% agree with you, Ed, with one exception. At a low power level, you measure the VISWR, it's a meaningful measurement. If you're getting a saturation characteristic of the Ballon, then as you go up in power, then VISWR can definitely change. And all the evidence we're seeing is that at high power, that antenna is giving a lot of reflective power that's creating a lot of damage in the output circuits of his antenna tuna. I know that George wanted to say something more. Go ahead, George, K2LAW.
Thank you, Dick. KT2FIU. What I was trying to establish here is a benchmark for a point of testing. As the antenna and its feed line comes in, isolate that as a divisive system. At one point, if it's working right, its reactants, its SWR, its dip where it is on the HF band is going to have a standard. Not worried about where it is on each of the amateur radio bands. It's going to have a dip somewhere. Its impedance, inductance, its capacitance, its whole reactant structure is going to have a profile. And my point is that when you want to isolate a trouble like this, you go in there and you look out and say, did that change? Then you take it back one step. You look at it through the amplifier. We're not yet wanting to tune to a frequency. You follow what I'm saying? KD2FIU.
That's one approach, George, which works for you. Not everybody wants to do it that way. Measuring the VISWR on each of the bands he's going to use is the most direct information he can use, but he's got to recognize the fact that the VISWR he measures, because of possible saturation of the balun, the VISWR could be very power sensitive. That's a fancy way of saying the dip you're talking about might not stay in the same place at a higher power level, because the electrical characteristics of the balun changes as a function of power, and that's part of the tuning of that antenna, so to speak. So there's a little...
Repeater, time out.
There's a little bit more going on here. Rich, I'm going to have to go on to the next person, because we've dwelled on this particular subject for quite a long time. And so you know something about the measurements that have to be done the next time somebody visits you. Let's see, Curtis, KC2DAW. I hope we haven't put you to sleep, Curtis. K2IAW in the ticknet. My name is Dick.
Oh, no. Everything's okay. I was just listening. But what I was thinking about that, the video I'm talking on now was the one that I had problem programming it with. Let me let it drop. And then, you know, I went over to my friend's place, Bob, and he helped me program it and stuff after I had sent away for the program, because the one that I had got that originally came with the radio didn't work. KC2DAW.
I'm hearing a very weak signal in the background, which we weren't able to make out. So, Curtis, what I right now don't know is that I think you're telling us that once you got the right program, you were able to program this difficult-to-program rig that you told us about a couple of weeks ago. And I think you're saying you're now in good operation. Is that the good news you're bringing us, Curtis? Go ahead.
Yep. Thanks to Bob, too, though. WA2AQQ. He helped me.
KE2EJ.
KE2EJ. 50% noise, 50% signal. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, for us, it's all conversation. The one thing that you guys seem to miss is that ferrite is a complex animal, and its permeability changes according to temperature, and a lot of the failures that occur at a molecular level in terms of how the material is compressed and how it's maintained together. And it's a complex process of putting ferrites together. There's a threshold point when you reach a certain temperature, things start to change rapidly. And if you keep going, you create permanent damage. So, and if you look at it on a Bethe-Necker analyzer, you'll find that it has a natural resonance. And as the temperature of the device changes, that resonance point moves. Just a point of order here. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Eric. And all the evidence we've had on Rich's grief over the last couple of months does suggest something very peculiar is happening, probably a saturation-like characteristic of the ferrite, of that pal star balun of his. Okay, sounds like Curtis is in good shape, and we're now going to go on to Rich number two, WB2GXN. Hope he's still awake. WB2GXN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich number two.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXN, Rich. Dick, you'll let me know if this question is not appropriate for the TechNet, I will understand. I've been waxing nostalgic about Radio Shack lately. I used to have three of them within very close proximity of my house. Of course, now they're all closed. And I was wondering if there are any stores that are comparable to it within reasonable distance of the Glen Oaks repeater. I mean, you know, you could get anything you want online nowadays, but if you needed something really quick, there was Radio Shack. Is there a store I can do that with now? WB2GXM.
Yeah, there's actually two places you can go.
Yeah, tell us about those places, Eric, and speak slowly because you're a little bit noisy.
Yeah, all right, I'm actually in a hospital in a bed, but we'll talk about that some other time. There is, in fact, there's a place called L&L Electronics, Lionel and Lionel. they have pretty much everything, and they still maintain a lot of stuff from the old days. So if you're looking for some old transistors and ICs and stuff like that, you'll find them there. They're on Robbins Lane, and you can look them up in the phone book, and you can also catch them online. There's another company called PRP, which is in Farmingdale. It's on, I can't think of the name of it. It's on Allen Boulevard, there you go. And then, it buys the stuff, so it's a problem with it. Chances are he's got it,
Queens, 168th Street area. That's not too far from them. It's like 10 minutes from them.
There's another one for you, Rich. Rich, you need any fills on that one? Over you, Rich.
Check. Good to hear from you, Guy. Thank you. In fact, Allstate is on my way to work, so I could just stop in there without the car. WBTGXM.
WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
My understanding is still a hobby town. We don't have it on Long Island yet, but they're dealing with a Radio Shack actually is becoming part of that. You know, I know there's one up in Connecticut and one down in Toms River, New Jersey, but nothing here yet. But, keep an eye out for that. Maybe they'll open up here. The idea is to bring it back to the suburbs. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we're really going to miss the old Radio Shack, or the old Arrow Electronics we had 30 years ago. And I can't think of the name of the one that was in Farmingdale on the east side of Route 110, close to that, right across the street, so to speak, from Farmingdale University.
Harrison.
Harrison Electronics, yeah. We miss all of these guys. And Harrison, and I see you. Can't even think of the name of the one I just mentioned earlier. As an efficiency expert comes along and tells them to eliminate the boxes of parts in the back room, that's the beginning of the end. That's a draw that got people into the store that has them buy other appliances. So those efficiency experts created the death of an awful lot of these places. I remember going into Radio Shack just 6 months or a year ago, trying to buy a 250-volt capacitor at a few microfarads. They didn't have it. And I would have to wait a month of Sundays to order it through them, if you know what I mean. So parts that I thought would be common, they didn't have anymore. Okay, we're going to go over to Roy. Roy likes an awful lot of participation. And he's got a great puzzle for you tonight about something that's really loud out there in space. AC2GS. Give us that big noise there. Puzzle, Roy. K2RIW and detect that.
By the way, Harrison still exists as a high-end hi-fi store in Manhattan.
So Harrison still exists in Manhattan. High-end hi-fi. Good to know, Eric. Thank you. Roy, you got it.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. Before I start, though, I just want to caution Curtis, KC2DAW. His radio is also owned by another person who's usually here on the TechNet, Rich, W2BZ, and he was running it apparently full power and probably blew out the final power transistors. So I would urge Curtis to not use the highest power setting, just to be cautious with that, because I think they tend to be overrated a bit. But that's just my advice to him. Getting back to the science talk, as always, if anyone has any topics, any questions, any reputations, what have you, the email address to get me at is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you're interested in any of the articles that I'm citing with these presentations, I make links to them and illustrations, nice photography that NASA provides on roy.ac2gs.com. Again, you just type it into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll get links and images that I'm alluding to. And also, we have a little chat room for the TechNet. It's at, you type in on your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and you got the chat room. So that's the usual stuff, and I'll let it drop for a moment, and then on with the show. Okay, supernovas with their massive gamma bursts are all a flash in the pan, right? Here today, gone tomorrow, but what are the brightest consistent objects in our universe? That's our question for tonight, and hopefully it'll engage people's interest. So what's the brightest consistent celestial object in our universe? I'm open for suggestions here.
BXM.
Yes, Rich.
Would be the quasar.
Al, this is going to be a real short puzzle, eh? Yes, you are quite right. It is the quasar. It is the brightest spot in our sky, and it's caused by the darkest object in our sky. But I'll riddle you this, Rich. Can you definitely say that there are active quasars out there right now in the...
I believe I could say that there are active quasars out there right now. WB2GXM.
Is it possible what you're referring to, Roy, is the fact that the quasars are blobs of extremely intense material at essentially the maximum range? In other words, they form very early after the Big Bang, it appears. And so one of these things might be 13 billion light years away from us. And does it still exist today in that form is a darn interesting question. That's what I think you're getting at. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Yep, Dick, that's the gist of the question. You know, we all talk about astronomical bodies as though they're all here with us in the present tense. And the interesting thing about astronomy is it's a lot about time travel. The farther out you look, the farther out in time you're looking. There are quasars out there on the very periphery of the known universe, which means we're gazing back, you know, 13 billion years ago. So although they were gangbusters back in the olden days, there's actually no real proof that they're much of anything today. I mean, it's all conjecture. That's the point I'm trying to make. I got a little spiel on it, but that's the gist.
I will venture that if neutron stars and black holes still exist, then there would still be quasars existing today.
Well, not necessarily. Let me do my little spiel, and then we'll circle back into that question. Okay, Rich?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay. Shining so brightly that they eclipse the ancient galaxies that contain them, quasars are distant objects powered by black holes a billion times as massive as our sun. These powerful dynamos have fascinated astronomers since their discovery half a century ago. In the 1930s, Carl Jansky, a physicist with Bell Telephone Laboratories, discovered that the static interference on transatlantic phone lines was coming from the Milky Way. By the 1950s, astronomers were using radio telescopes to probe the heavens, pairing their signals with visible examinations of the heavens. However, some of the smaller point source objects didn't have a match. Astronomers called them quasi-stellar radio sources, or quasars, because the signals came from one place, like a star. However, the name is rather a misnomer. According to the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan, only about 10% of quasars actually emit strong radio waves, and they don't really come from a star. Naming them didn't help determine what these objects were. It took years of study to realize that these distant specks, which seem to indicate stars, are created by particles accelerated at velocities approaching the speed of light. Let me drop for a second. Scientists now suspect that the tiny point-like glimmers are actually signals from galactic nuclei outshining their host galaxy. Quasars live only in galaxies with supermassive black holes. These black holes, they contain billions of times the mass of our sun. Although light cannot escape from a black hole itself, some signals can break free around its edges. While some dust and gas fall into the black hole, other particles are accelerated away from it at near speed of light. The particles stream away from the black holes in jets above and below it, transported by one of the most powerful particle accelerators in our universe. Quasars emit energies of millions, billions, even trillions of electron volts. This energy exceeds the total of the light of all the stars within a galaxy. The brightest objects in our universe shine anywhere from 10 to 100,000 times brighter than our Milky Way. In December 2017, the most distant quasar was found sitting more than 13 billion light years from Earth. Scientists observed the quasar, known as the catching term J1342 plus 0928, as it appeared only 690 million years ago after the Big Bang. Quasars this young can reveal information about how the galaxy evolved over time. Let me drop for a second. Astronomy of distant bodies is a lot like time travel. As I mentioned before, the farther objects are, the farther back through the history of the universe astronomers peer at. Most quasars have been found billions of light years away. Most of the more than 2,000 known quasars existed in the early life of the galaxy. Galaxies like the Milky Way may have hosted a quasar that has long since gone silent. The closest quasar observed was the very first quasar documented in 1970. It was called 3C273, located in the constellation Virgo. It's the brightest quasar in our sky, but and only 1.7 billion light years away from our neighborhood. That means that when our astronomers look at it, they are gazing back 1.7 billion years. Who knows if these quasars can still survive in this older universe of ours. The closest X-quasar we know of is called IC2497. It's only located 730 million light years away in time and space, and it's believed to have flamed out about 70,000 years ago from our time-shifted point of view of that celestial object. So we really don't know if they're still among us or we're just looking at ghosts. And getting back to Ridge, the black hole probably will not evaporate because large super black holes take eternities to evaporate, but you need a lot of material to fall into them, and after a while, young galaxies run out of that local material to fall in and produce the reaction. So, although the black hole itself might be there, the other ingredients that make for quasars might not. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
KC2DAW, I have a comment.
Yes, Curtis.
Okay, I wanted to thank the other station, I don't remember his call letters, he just said it too, about the info about the power setting on the radio. Thank you.
You're welcome, Curtis. I mentioned it as a reference from Rich W2BZ, who owned the same radio as you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
No problem, Curtis. Enjoy your radio. So getting back to you, Rich, does that make any sense that even though there's still massive black holes, which are one half of the equation of quasars, that there might not be large dust clouds that can fall into the black hole and produce the effects of a quasar?
It does, Roy.
Okay, very good. If anyone else has any comments or questions about this particular little puzzle, that went very, very quick, thanks to my very smart participants, please let me know. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next topic.
Would it be safe to say that all of the quasars that we see, the really bright ones, seem to be at the maximum range, and the quasars that are closer to us appear to be closer to the burnout time, so to speak. In other words, there's no really bright, loud quasars close to us, with rare exception. Is that pretty much true?
Well, it depends what you... the closest one that's active is 1.7 billion light years from us, and as far as we know, its absolute magnitude is the greatest of the ones that are documented. It's, I think, 12.9 magnitude, which is high for quasars. So it's not necessarily so that the farther back in time, the more powerful the quasars necessarily, although we may simply lack the ability to gaze into enough of the very beginning of the universe to get a good statistical number of quasars to make that judgment. But the brightest one, again, as far as astronomers document, is a relatively close one. It's only 1.7 billion light years away.
And when you say brightest, are you talking about apparent brightness or absolute brightness, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, these are in absolute brightness terms, is my understanding.
Zulu with a question.
That's Rich.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu with a question.
Yes, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Question away.
Well, this may be way too general. You may want to entertain it or not, but as you were going through this stuff, you know, a certainty of quoting science, what could we be most wrong about? Like I said, that may be too broad for now or forever, but that's my question.
Yeah, I would agree. That's very broad. We could be wrong about absolutely everything. There are curious theories outside that trouble me greatly, and one of them is called the holographic theory, all of this is merely an illusion, that we are merely a holographic projection off of an event horizon in a massive black hole, which troubles me. I would prefer to be what I perceive myself to be, as opposed to a holographic projection of me.
Well, can it be? I mean, if you put the top 20 astrophysicists in a room, you think that would bother them the most? Or is there something that is troublesome to everybody, but they try not to let it affect them too much, if you know what I mean?
Nothing's written in stone, if you prefer that way of explaining things. People argue about the details. They argue about the big pictures. They argue about everything. The Big Bang is not set in stone. And there are different flavors of the Big Bang theory, and you can go on and on and on. People don't know if the universe is open, closed, bound, unbound, turns in on itself, expands out, whether even gravity changes over time. There's a heck of a lot of questions. You know, science is a search for knowledge. It's not a arrogance that we figured it all out and the rest of you can just go on with your business. So, you know, science doesn't know everything. Science learns a little bit around the edges and aspires to learn even more.
So there's a point of certainty beyond which everybody would agree we don't know?
Rich, there's no certainty that you are who you are. I mean, for all you know, you could be a dream someone else is having. We could get very philosophical and very existential. The only thing that I have is a belief in things that make sense to me and that follow one after the other and don't contradict and aren't disproved by experimental evidence. That's the best I can go on. That's probably the best practical scientist. Theoretical scientists have a much wider imagination and can imagine all kinds of wonderment out there.
What I, you know, have learned from you and from other people about space and deep space is there is stuff that has been scientifically proven, right? Like the origin of a moon rock or whatever. So there must be, I got myself confused. I mean, has the stuff that's been scientifically proven, could that be as easily unproven? You know, the stuff that we have hard evidence about, like on Mars with the rover and things like that.
Well, you know, we're human beings, and we're fallible. So can we make mistakes? Can we consider evidence incorrectly and come to the wrong conclusion? Well, we have in the past, and we probably will in the future. And hopefully there is a self-correcting aspect to science as well, where we always kind of retest our suppositions and look for flaws in it. So again, It's sort of built in the system. You're always kind of questioning yourself. I always question myself. Some of the stuff that I believe can sound rather flighty, and I look for better and better ways of explaining it, analogies, and practical consistencies in the universe to indicate that this is not just some wild theoretician's imagination gone mad. Because, you know, you go back to the ancient Greeks, and they philosophized all kinds of foolish nonsense about the humors in the human body and the four elements and such. And it sounded good at the time, but it was based on nothingness. And so I look for consistency and lack of contradiction.
I thought it was too, but thanks for entertaining it, Roy. W2BZ.
No problem, Rich. I don't mind waxing philosophical once in a while. It's a nice change of pace. Because, you know, when I start to talk about how these things are and I give actual numbers and figures and such, it sounds like everything's locked down. When unfortunately a lot of things aren't quite locked down as much as I'd like them to. But I think I'd be disappointed if I knew everything about everything, because there would be nothing new to learn. So, and I, God knows, I certainly have a lot more to learn.
Great term, lockdown. That's where my question emanated from. You know, what's locked down and what's not, but for some other time, maybe. Thanks a lot, Roy. W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. Anyone with any other further questions or comments before I jump to the next topic? Okay, you might remember I posted a nice image of the object Ultima Thule taken by New Horizons. That was about 3-4 weeks ago, I think. In that picture, it sort of looked like a snowman on its side. Now, there's more recent images that show how truly strange Ultima Thule really is. The distant 2014 MU69 object, nicknamed Ultima Thule, made history on New Year's Day for becoming the farthest object ever visited by a spacecraft, as it's situated in the Kuiper Belt, about 4.1 billion miles from Earth. There's not much about MU69 that scientists were... There's much about the MU69, rather, that scientists are still learning now. New images have raised even more questions about the mysterious object. So little was known about MU69 prior to the flyby that NASA wasn't even sure whether it was a single object or two objects orbiting each other. Scientists discovered its snowman-like structure after New Horizons began sending images to us on Earth. Last Friday, NASA released a video compiled using more than a dozen images that show Ultima Thule may actually be much flatter than initially thought. Let me drop for a second. The images were captured January 1st, more than 5,000 miles beyond MU69 after New Horizons zoomed past it. According to NASA, scientists were able to deduce its shape by tracing the part of these images that blocked out the stars in the background on the side that wasn't clearly outlined by the sun. One lobe looks kind of like an oddly shaped walnut, the agency said, while the other side looks more like a pancake. It would be closest to reality to say the MU69 shape is flatter, like a pancake, but more importantly, the new images are creating scientific puzzles about how such an object could even be formed. We've never seen anything like this orbiting the sun before. Let me drop for a second. While NASA's New Horizons zipped by Ultima Thule over a month ago, NASA scientists will continue receiving data from the object well over a year from now. Initial estimates around the time of its flyby said it would take about 20 months for the spacecraft to beam back the entire load of images and other scientific data. And the images will just be getting better and better, or stranger and stranger. So check out the pretty strange images I've posted of Ultima Thule on the website, roy.ac2gs.com. It's there, and it's very, very strange indeed. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I guess on to the next. Another sign of the top... Now, I've seen this happen with my VHS tapes. I've seen it happen with my laser discs. I've seen it happen with my poor DVDs. And now, it seems to be that my Blu-ray's time has come, and Samsung has given up on Blu-rays, at least in the United States, where it's given up on producing new models of Blu-rays and 4K Blu-ray players. A prior report in Forbes suggested that Samsung was only planning on discontinuing the 4K players and would continue to release the 1080p devices, though the company confirmed in a release statement that it's no longer releasing either. A 4K model was planned for release this year, but it will never see the light of day. Samsung launched its last 4K players in 2017 and didn't add any new models to its lineup in 2018. A high-end 4K player for 2019 along the lines of its UBD M9500 was in the works, a Forbes report said, but has now been scrapped. Let me drop for a second. This is not entirely surprising. The 4K UHD Blu-ray market is growing fast, but disc sales in general fell by double digits. About 11.5% in the third quarter of 2018, per Variety. The growth of streaming may have left the format without much of a future. Last year, competitor Oppo also dropped out of the Blu-ray market. The Digital Entertainment Group said that 2.3 million devices capable of playing 4K Blu-rays were purchased in the United States in the first 9 months of 2018, but a lot of those were in game consoles that might never play disc-based movies. Meanwhile, subscription video services reach many times that number of households. Netflix alone is in 150 million range. It seems like there is a significant number of consumers who don't think they need an expensive Blu-ray player to enjoy movies. Additionally, Samsung's devices didn't support Dolby Vision or other versions in the Blu-ray market. In any case, the Blu-rays are not quite going the way of the dinosaur yet. They remain the best way for home viewing as close to movie theater quality as possible, but they are being undercut by the rise of streaming. Samsung's competitors aren't giving up yet, with both Sony planning a new launch of this year and Panasonic having just launched its players. This is the inevitable downside of the march of new technology. Perfectly serviceable technology can get lost in the noise. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
It would follow that many people do not believe they need to actually own a copy of something in order to view it, and they assume that that whatever that is will be around forever. WB2GXM.
KZJ.
One second, Eric. Let me just answer Rich. Well, the trouble is ultimately, even if you own the Blu-ray disc, it's encrypted. Yes, you can decrypt it, and then they'll re-encrypt it, and then you can decrypt it again. There's a back and forth with all these things in that the medium is not inseparable from the device to read it. If the companies that manufacture the DVD and the Blu-ray and such stop doing it and the old machines break down, all you have is a piece of plastic that reflects nice patterns. So do you really own the movie, or do you really own the movie in a format that's transitory?
A sad point taken. You need that DVD or Blu-ray player.
And that was one of the problems that I personally had with LaserDiscs. I loved LaserDiscs because the only thing else at the time was VHS, and VHS, Super VHS, I think, was something like 300 scan lines. Regular VHS was 200 scan lines for an entire image. LaserDisc was all 400 lines. It was pristine for the day. It got to the point where the only manufacturer was Pioneer, and they stopped really selling for the most part, or grudgingly selling a professional model and not really cutting costs in any way. So It's no fun when you think you own a movie and then you find out that since the delivery system is independent from you, that you don't. Now, if you're a clever person and you reduce these video signals into files that can be compressed and uncompressed on computers, and the computers will be upgraded year in and year out, then you sort of have the software, you sort of have the actual medium, and you don't need the disc and you don't need the streamers. Some people like streaming, it's just more convenient for them. They don't worry about the future. If we all worried about the future, we'd probably make less mistakes. Yes, Eric, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I was wondering whether in any of these releases they talk about interactive media and its role in life and its purpose. That's pretty much for within the computer industry itself. So does it mean that they're really just not interested in putting movies on DVD and still maintain other purposes? Well, the other thing is when you buy a movie, you don't own the movie. You have bought a license to have the movie. So well, most people think that they own it. They actually don't. You basically purchase a license to have that movie in whatever form of media you have. Turn it into a file, they can't bother you, even though you're breaking the rules in terms of decrypting it. And by the way, the Blu-ray decrypting is quite a bit harder than it is to DVD. KC2GS, KC2GS.
Thank you, Eric. Well, I mean, like all things, it gets complicated. There are fair use issues that even though you theoretically do not own the movie that you bought, you only own that copy of it, you can actually make a copy for your own purposes, which would sort of violate the sensibility that it's not yours in the first place. But fair use is legally acceptable. And you can actually, there are software out there that have broken the Blu-ray keys. You give them enough time. The problem with cryptographic encoding of things where consumers get the hardware to decrypt it is smart, clever people can actually use the hardware that decrypts it and sniff the encryption code and break the encryption code. And that's why every so often you'll get an upgrade to your DVD or Blu-ray player in which they install new keys into the encryption chain. But there are other guys who will just break them as they often will. So, yeah, there's always this give or take. Film companies and such would love you to just rent because there's more money in it for renting than buying. But some people get around that.
Now, one of the neat tricks that the manufacturers do is they actually write on a portion of the disc that most Blu-ray writers and players won't access. So that's one way. I think one of the, I think it was the Sony PS gameplay, and they wrote on the outer lip of the disc where the highest velocity is. And they pack encryption keys in there. There's all sorts of games that they play, but in the end, you can break them all. No, but if there's no money in it, why do it?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
B2BC.
Yeah, Rich recognized Eric was saying something and then got cut off with the, you know, with the repeater.
All right, I'm done, so. H2GSK2GSK.
Yeah, very good, Eric. Yeah, I mean, software, hardware, you have companies building locks, and then you have lock pickers opening the locks. What was very popular for a while, especially among game producers, were to introduce bad sectors into the disc and have the software look for the bad sector. If you copied them, most software wasn't smart enough to look at and replicate a bad sector. It would simply detect a bad sector and skip it. And then when the software looked for the bad sector, wouldn't find it, and it would call up a preferable and your game was safe from pirates. But that was an old one. But, you know, they're trying to come up with things new every day because there's a lot. There's billions of dollars in this industry, and there's a lot of people with too much free time looking into how to break everything. And so it's a cat-and-mouse game. Fascinating to watch on the sidelines, but I don't know. I like hard copies of my movies and such, so that I don't have to worry about machines going out of date.
Yeah, one of the things that most people don't realize is that the dyes in recordable disc, organic dyes, and they degrade over time. And you're lucky if you get 3 to 5 years out of a recordable disc.
Yeah, I mean, although I used them at one time when I had little choice because nothing quite had the same price performance ratio. Nowadays, hard disks are so dirt cheap that I have multiple copies of everything on multiple hard drives. And so if one hard drive fails, I have network arrayed systems that have redundancy RAIDs. You've spoken on the TechNet about RAID redundancies and such. And so there's lots of ways to protect your data in the clouds or in redundant drive systems. You know, it depends if you believe in wearing a belt and suspenders at the same time, then you're not going to have your pants fall off.
Two Bravo Zulu.
I'm going to finish it. I'm a glutton for punishment. Actually, I store everything on tape, LTO tape, which is really very good. It's a good format, and it works very well.
A1J2.
Okay, one sec. I use tape once upon a time. I still remember the darn thing used a SCSI interface. I mean, talk about the ancient times.
Yeah, well, now you get them with USB Type-C, which is actually still the back end is still the SCSI interface. But, for the LSIs you got today, nobody cares. And the LCO tapes, one cassette now holds 500 gigabytes. So if you want to go a little more expensive, you want to compress, you get them over a terabyte. So tape is cheap.
Okay, very good, Eric. I haven't really considered the tape for a long time. I kind of went from tape to probably CDs, from CDs to burnable DVDs, from burnable DVDs to burnable Blu-rays, and then back to hard drives. Since you can buy a 4 terabyte drive for $150 or something. It's a song and a dance. It's a lot easier than shuffling around with discs or tapes, but you know, whatever works for you. Anyway, Rich, W2BZ, you wanted to say something?
I wanted to ask a question, probably best answered by Eric. With all the TV manufacturers selling, 4K now, it's become ubiquitous. Does that mean that the last mile problem, in other words, the pipe from the pole to the house or from right before the pole to the house has been solved, Eric? Do you know?
Well, that'll really be the day. You've got different methods of getting it. If you're talking about consumer, like Fios, where they actually magnify the to your house, as opposed to cable vision, where they terminate the fiber on the pole and bring the rest of the to your house via coax. Same thing with the fiber. Once fiber gets into the pole, it becomes coax into your cable modem and your TV goes to coax and so forth. So, unless you turn the light off on you, and it's going away anytime soon.
I heard about.
Okay, Rich, question answered.
I really like. All of a sudden, that was the biggest problem. How do you get that kind of resolution into the home? And, the basic question is, have they solved getting that type of resolution into the home? And does anybody really need any more than that?
They're coming out with 4K sets now. You can buy them. I mean, who in God's name needs them is beyond me. But We can get that kind of resolution now. It's just a matter of bandwidth or how you want to allocate it. Small Cablevision and Fios and various other services out there. It's all around. It's all having a fixed amount of bandwidth and how you divvy it up.
I know it's a question about that. The last I, you know, looked that to get that kind of bandwidth was too expensive home. So I guess I'm answering my own question. It has been solved, that problem. Go ahead, Roy. Thanks.
Okay, very good, Rich. Well, I mean, basically, they've done a bunch of things. Compression algorithms and computational abilities have increased so that you can squeeze bigger things into smaller packages, thankfully. And you don't even need all of that data. They're using upscaling that uses some degree of artificial intelligence to kind of augment detail into lack of detail containing lower resolution images. So it's amazing. You can see, since I tend to watch television without my my glasses, my distance glasses on, actually 700 and change is perfectly fine with me. Now, I can understand why people need the shiniest, newest, biggest resolution available.
I personally like the 1080i for a lot of reasons, and I'm also into what my eyes can temporarily get, take your glasses off. Sit back about 20 feet and you don't need anything. But as far as like, you know, you can get the bandwidth if you want, you can sacrifice something. I think you would say reduce the bandwidth of something else, or they reduce the bitrate of something else, it gives you the higher bitrate of whatever it is you want. Hey, most people don't realize that 1080i is 1.16 gigabits per second. That's a lot of bits going by, but nobody transmits it raw. It's just compressed 200 to 1. Think about that. It's compressed. And the temporal and the motion artifacts, you just bite the crap out of me when you're watching a really expensive TV set, and it has an up converter in it. The up converter doesn't do a very nice job. I mean, when we do up conversion in the professional world, you're talking about, you know, $50,000 or $70,000 box to do what a stinking little chip is going to do inside the TV set. So, you know, I'd much rather watch native resolution than up converter because it turns it into crap.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I don't need the up resolution, the up scanning either, but you know better than I do that silicon gets better over time until we hit some kind of a glass ceiling. And ultimately, most likely, there'll be little chips that do as well as the $75,000 machinery that you now use. So it's only a matter of time before, you know, artificial intelligence will take a very, very simple description of a scene and generate it on the fly.
Well, that's very true. But, you know, it's really not the hardware. It's the mathematics involved. And if you understand how we do compression, how we take multiple different compression schemes and combine them into one, then we use the mathematics of discrete cosine transforms and remnant encoding and a few other things. You know, you can appreciate what they did back in the late 70s, early 80s, it started this whole revolution, and it still continues today, and it's all based on what came before. So you can see that too, people.
Well, yes, Eric. I mean, that's the nature of all things. The giants of today stand on the shoulders of giants of yesterday. They didn't come up with this out of nothingness. They grew into this, and a lot of the lossy compression algorithms were available on a theoretical basis long ago, but there was no silicon that was capable of manipulating the numbers at the speeds necessary for anything practical to be done until the last few decades. But yeah, it's sort of amazing how much we can squeeze down. It's not lossless, it's lossy compression, but still it's amazing how little data our eyes really need to kind of figure out the scene that we're looking at.
Well, that being said, a lot of it is based on the studies of how the eyeball sees and how the ear hears. And, you know, Dolby AC3 is based on what does your ear hear and what doesn't your ear hear.
if you're listening to Beethoven's Fifth and you're in a large crescendo and I have to see a little triangle in the background, ACC says, you can't hear it. It's psychoacoustical compression. Therefore, I'm not going to transmit and waste some data space based on that. You do the same thing visually. But the interesting thing is back in the late 70s, when MPEG was being invented, it actually would take an A...